a pleasant place to live in. Georgis lost his temper very little, however, all things considered. It was because of Ona. The least glance at her was always enough to make him control himself. She was so sensitive. She was not fitted for such a life as this. And 100 times a day, when he thought of her, he would clench his hands and fling himself again at the task before him. She was too good for him, he told himself, and he was afraid, because she was his. So long he had hungered to possess her, but now that the time had come, he knew he had not earned the right. That she trusted him so was all her own simple goodness and no virtue of his. But he was resolved that she should never find this out, and so was always on the watch to see that he did not betray any of his ugly self. He would take care even in little matters, such as his manners and his habit of swearing when things went wrong. The tears came so easily into Ona's eyes, and she would look at him so appealingly. It kept Georgis quite busy making resolutions, in addition to all the other things he had on his mind. It was true that more things were going on at this time in the mind of Georgis than ever had in all his life before. He had to protect her, to do battle for her, against the horror he saw about them. He was all that she had to look to, and if he failed, she would be lost. He would wrap his arms about her and try to hide her from the world. He had learned the ways of things about him now. It was a war of each against all, and the devil take the hindmost. You did not give feasts to other people. You waited for them to give feasts to you. You went about with your soul full of suspicion and hatred. You understood that you were environed by hostile powers that were trying to get your money, and who used all the virtues to bait their traps with. The storekeepers plastered up their windows with all sorts of lies to entice you. The very fences by the wayside, the lampposts and telegraph poles were pasted over with lies. The great corporation which employed you lied to you, and lied to the whole country. From top to bottom, it was nothing but one gigantic lie. So Georgis said that he understood it. And yet it was really pitiful, for the struggle was so unfair. Some had so much advantage. Here he was, for instance, vowing upon his knees that he would save Ona from harm, and only a week later she was suffering atrociously, and from the blow of an enemy that he could not possibly have thwarted. There came a day when the rain fell in torrents, and it being December, to be wet with it, and have to sit all day long in one of the cold cellars of Brown's was no laughing matter. Ona was a working girl, and did not own waterproofs and such things, and so Georgis took her and put her on the streetcar. Now it chanced that this car line was owned by gentlemen who were trying to make money. And the city, having passed an ordinance requiring them to give transfers, they had fallen into a rage. And first they had made a rule that transfers could be had only when the fare was paid, and later, growing still uglier, they had made another, that the passenger must ask for the transfer. The conductor was not allowed to offer it. Now Ona had been told that she was to get a transfer, but it was not her way to speak up, and so she merely waited, following the conductor about with her eyes, wondering when he would think of her. When at last the time came for her to get out, she asked for her transfer and was refused. Not knowing what to make of this, she began to argue with the conductor in a language of which he did not understand a word. After warning her several times, he pulled the bell and the car went on, at which Ona burst into tears. At the next corner she got out, of course, and as she had no more money, she had to walk the rest of the way to the yards in the pouring rain. And so all day long she sat shivering and came home at night with her teeth chattering and pains in her head and back. For 2 weeks afterward she suffered cruelly, and yet every day she had to drag herself to work. The forewoman was especially severe with Ona, because she believed that she was obstinate on account of having been refused a holiday the day after her wedding. Ona had an idea that her forelady did not like to have her girls marry, perhaps because she was old and ugly and unmarried herself. There were many such dangers in which the odds were all against them. Their children were not as well as they had been at home, but how could they know there was no sewer to their house and that the drainage of 15 years was in a cesspool under it? How could they know that the pale blue milk that they bought around the corner was watered and doctored with formaldehyde besides? When the children were not well at home, Tete Elzbieta would gather herbs and cure them. Now she was obliged to go to the drugstore and buy extracts. And how was she to know that they were all adulterated? How could they find out that their tea and coffee, their sugar and flour had been doctored, that their canned peas had been colored with copper salts, and their fruit jams with aniline dyes? And even if they had known it, what good would it have done them, since there was no place within miles of them where any other sort was to be had? The bitter winter was coming, and they had to save money to get more clothing and bedding, but it would not matter in the least how much they saved. They could not get anything to keep them warm. All the clothing that was to be had in the stores was made of cotton and shoddy, which is made by tearing old clothes to pieces and weaving the fiber again. If they paid higher prices, they might get frills and fanciness, or be cheated. But genuine quality they could not obtain for love nor money. A young friend of Shed Vilas's, recently come from abroad, had become a clerk in a store on Ashland Avenue, and he narrated with glee a trick that had been played upon an unsuspecting countryman by his boss. The customer had desired to purchase an alarm clock, and the boss had shown him two exactly similar, telling him that the price of one was $1, and of the other $1.75. Upon being asked what the difference was, the man had wound up the first halfway and the second all the way, and showed the customer how the latter made twice as much noise. Upon which the customer remarked that he was a sound sleeper and had better take the more expensive clock. There is a poet who sings that deeper their heart grows and nobler their bearing, whose youth in the fires of anguish hath died. But it is not likely that he had reference to the kind of anguish that comes with destitution that is so endlessly bitter and cruel, and yet so sordid and petty, so ugly, so humiliating, unredeemed by the slightest touch of dignity or even of pathos. It is a kind of anguish that poets have not commonly dealt with. Its very words are not admitted into the vocabulary of poets. The details of it cannot be told in polite society at all. How, for instance, could anyone expect to excite sympathy among lovers of good literature by telling how a family found their home alive with vermin, and of all the suffering and inconvenience and humiliation they were put to, and the hard-earned money they spent in efforts to get rid of them? After long hesitation and uncertainty, they paid 25 cents for a big package of insect powder, a patent preparation which chanced to be 95% gypsum, a harmless earth which had cost about 2 cents to prepare. Of course, it had not the least effect, except upon a few roaches which had the misfortune to drink water after eating it, and so got their inwards set in a coating of Paris. The family, having no idea of this and no more money to throw away, had nothing to do but give up and submit to one more misery for the rest of their days. Then there was old Antanas. The winter came, and the place where he worked was a dark, unheated cellar, where you could see your breath all day, and where your fingers sometimes tried to freeze. So the old man's cough grew every day worse, until there came a time when it hardly ever stopped, and he had become a nuisance about the place. Then, too, a still more dreadful thing happened to him. He worked in a place where his feet were soaked in chemicals, and it was not long before they had eaten through his new boots. Then sores began to break out on his feet and grow worse and worse. Whether it was that his blood was bad or there had been a cut, he could not say. But he asked the man about it and learned that it was a regular thing. It was the saltpeter. Everyone felt it, sooner or later, and then it was all up with him, at least for that sort of work. The sores would never heal. In the end, his toes would drop off if he did not quit. Yet old Antanas would not quit. He saw the suffering of his family, and he remembered what it had cost him to get a job. So he tied up his feet and went on limping about and coughing until at last he fell to pieces, all at once and in a heap, like the one-horse shay. They carried him to a dry place and laid him on the floor, and that night two of the men helped him home. The poor old man was put to bed, and though he tried it every morning until the end, he never could get up again. He would lie there and cough, day and night, wasting away to a mere skeleton. There came a time when there was so little flesh on him that the bones began to poke through. which was a horrible thing to see or even to think of. And one night he had a choking fit, and a little river of blood came out of his mouth. The family, wild with terror, sent for a doctor and paid $50 to be told that there was nothing to be done. Mercifully, the doctor did not say this so that the old man could hear, for he was still clinging to the faith that tomorrow or next day he would be better and could go back to his job. The company had sent word to him that they would keep it for him, or rather, Jurgis had bribed one of the men to come one Sunday afternoon and say they had. Dede Antanas continued to believe it, while three more hemorrhages came, and then at last, one morning, they found him stiff and cold. Things were not going well with them then, and though it nearly broke Teta Elzbieta's heart, they were forced to dispense with nearly all the decencies of a funeral. They had only a hearse and one hack for the women and children. And Jurgis, who was learning things fast, spent all Sunday making a bargain for these, and he made it in the presence of witnesses so that when the man tried to charge him for all sorts of incidentals, he did not have to pay. For 25 years, old Antanas Rutkus and his son had dwelt in the forest together, and it was hard to part in this way. Perhaps it was just as well that Jurgis had to give all his attention to the task of having a funeral without being bankrupted, and so had no time to indulge in memories and grief. Now the dreadful winter had come upon them. In the forests all summer long, the branches of the trees do battle for light, and some of them lose and die. And then come the raging blasts and the storms of snow and hail, and strew the ground with these weaker branches. Just so it was in Packingtown. The whole district braced itself for the struggle that was an agony, and those whose time was come died off in hordes. All the year round they had been serving as cogs in the great packing machine, and now is the time for the renovating of it and the replacing of damaged parts. There came pneumonia and grip, stalking among them, seeking for weakened constitutions. There was the annual harvest of those whom tuberculosis had been dragging down. There came cruel, cold, and biting winds and blizzards of snow, all testing relentlessly for failing muscles and impoverished blood. Sooner or later came the day when the unfit one did not report for work. And then, with no time lost in waiting and no inquiries or regrets, there was a chance for a new hand. The new hands were here by the thousands. All day long the gates of the packing houses were besieged by starving and penniless men. They came, literally, by the thousands every single morning, fighting with each other for a chance for life. Blizzards and cold made no difference to them. They were always on hand. They were on hand 2 hours before the sun rose, an hour before the work began. Sometimes their faces froze, sometimes their feet and their hands, sometimes they froze altogether. But still they came, for they had no other place to go. One day, Durham advertised in the paper for 200 men to cut ice, and all that day the homeless and starving of the city came trudging through the snow from all over its 200 square miles. That night 40 score of them crowded into the station house of the stockyards district. They filled the rooms, sleeping in each other's laps, toboggan fashion, and they piled on top of each other in the corridors till the police shut the doors and left some to freeze outside. On the morrow, before daybreak, there were 3,000 at Durham's, and the police reserves had to be sent for to quell the riot. Then Durham's bosses picked out 20 of the biggest. The 200 proved to have been a printer's error. 4 or 5 miles to the eastward lay the lake, and over this the bitter winds came raging. Sometimes the thermometer would fall to 10 or 20 degrees below zero at night, and in the morning the streets would be piled with snowdrifts up to the first floor windows. The streets through which our friends had to go to their work were all unpaved and full of deep holes and gullies. In summer, when it rained hard, a man might have to wade to his waist to get to his house. And now in winter, it was no joke getting through these places before light in the morning and after dark at night. They would wrap up in all they owned, but they could not wrap up against exhaustion, and many a man gave out in these battles with the snowdrifts and lay down and fell asleep. And if it was bad for the men, one may imagine how the women and children fared, Some would ride in the cars if the cars were running, but when you are making only 5 cents an hour, as was little Stanislovas, you do not like to spend that much to ride 2 miles. The children would come to the yards with great shawls about their ears, and so tied up that you could hardly find them, and still there would be accidents. One bitter morning in February, the little boy who worked at the lard machine with Stanislovas came about an hour late, and screaming with pain. They unwrapped him, and a man began vigorously rubbing his ears, and as they were frozen stiff, it took only 2 or 3 rubs to break them short off. As a result of this, little Stanislovas conceived a terror of the cold that was almost a mania. Every morning when it came time to start for the yards, he would begin to cry in protest. Nobody knew quite how to manage him, for threats did no good. It seemed to be something that he could not control, and they feared sometimes that he would go into convulsions. In the end, it had to be arranged that he always went with Jurgis and came home with him again, and often, when the snow was deep, the man would carry him the whole way on his shoulders. Sometimes Jurgis would be working until late at night, and then it was pitiful, for there was no place for the little fellow to wait, save in the doorways or in a corner of the killing beds, and he would all but fall asleep there and freeze to death. There was no heat upon the killing beds. The men might exactly as well have worked out of doors all winter. For that matter, there was but very little heat anywhere in the building, except in the cooking rooms and such places, and it was the men who worked in these who ran the most risk of all, because whenever they had to pass to another room, they had to go through ice-cold corridors, and sometimes with nothing on above the waist except a sleeveless undershirt. On the killing beds, you were apt to be covered with blood, and it would freeze solid. If you leaned against a pillar, you would freeze to that, and if you put your hand upon the blade of your knife, you would run a chance of leaving your skin on it. The men would tie up their feet in newspapers and old sacks, and these would be soaked in blood and frozen, and then soaked again and so on, until by nighttime a man would be walking on great lumps the size of the feet of an elephant. Now and then, when the bosses were not looking, you would see them plunging their feet and ankles into the steaming hot carcass of the steer, or darting across the room to the hot water jets. The cruelest thing of all was that nearly all of them, all of those who used knives, were unable to wear gloves, and their arms would be white with frost, and their hands would grow numb. And then, of course, there would be accidents. Also, the air would be full of steam from the hot water and the hot blood, so that you could not see 5 feet before you. And then, with men rushing about at the speed they kept up on the killing beds, and all with butcher knives like razors in their hands, well, it was to be counted as a wonder that there were not more men slaughtered than cattle. And yet all this inconvenience they might have put up with, if only it had not been for one thing, if only there had been some place where they might eat. Jurgis had either to eat his dinner amid the stench in which he had worked, or else to rush, as did all his companions, to any one of the hundreds of liquor stores which stretched out their arms to him. To the west of the yards ran Ashland Avenue, and there was an unbroken line of saloons. Whiskey Row, they called it. To the north was 47th Street, where there were half a dozen to the block, and at the angle of the two was Whiskey Point, a space of 15 or 20 acres and containing 1 glue factory and about 200 saloons. One might walk among these and take his choice. Hot pea soup and boiled cabbage today, sauerkraut and hot frankfurters, walk in. Bean soup and stewed lamb, welcome. All of these things were printed in many languages, as were also the names of the resorts, which were infinite in their variety and appeal. There was the Home Circle and the Cozy Corner. There were firesides and hearthstones and pleasure palaces and wonderlands and dream castles and love's delights. Whatever else they were called, they were sure to be called Union Headquarters, and to hold out a welcome to workingmen. And there was always a warm stove and a chair near it, and some friends to laugh and talk with. There was only one condition attached. You must drink. If you went in not intending to drink, you would be put out in no time. And if you were slow about going, like as not, you would get your head split open with a beer bottle in the bargain. But all of the men understood the convention and drank. They believed that, by it, they were getting something for nothing. For they did not need to take more than one drink, and upon the strength of it, they might fill themselves up with a good hot dinner. This did not always work out in practice, however, for there was pretty sure to be a friend who would treat you, and then you would have to treat him. Then someone else would come in, and anyhow, a few drinks were good for a man who worked hard. As he went back, he did not shiver so. He had more courage for his task. The deadly, brutalizing monotony of it did not afflict him so. He had ideas while he worked, and took a more cheerful view of his circumstances. On the way home, however, the shivering was apt to come on him again, and so he would have to stop once or twice to warm up against the cruel cold. As there were hot things to eat in this saloon, too, he might get home late to his supper, or he might not get home at all. And then his wife might set out to look for him, and she, too, would feel the cold, and perhaps she would have some of the children with her, and so a whole family would drift into drinking, as the current of a river drifts downstream. As if to complete the chain, the packers all paid their men in checks, refusing all requests to pay in coin. And where in Packingtown could a man go to have his check cashed but a saloon, where he could pay for the favor by spending a part of the money? From all of these things, Jorgis was saved because of Ona. He never would take but one drink at noontime, and so he got the reputation of being a surly fellow, and was not quite welcome at the saloons, and had to drift about from one to another. Then at night he would go straight home, helping Ona and Stanislovas, or often putting the former on a car, and when he got home, perhaps, he would have to trudge several blocks and come staggering back through the snowdrifts with a bag of coal upon his shoulder. Home was not a very attractive place, at least not this winter. They had only been able to buy one stove, and this was a small one, and proved not big enough to warm even the kitchen in the bitterest weather. This made it hard for Teta Elzbieta all day and for the children when they could not get to school. At night they would sit huddled round this stove while they ate their supper off their laps, and then Jorgis and Jonas would smoke a pipe, after which they would all crawl into their beds to get warm, after putting out the fire to save the coal. Then they would have some frightful experiences with the cold. They would sleep with all their clothes on, including their overcoats, and put over them all the bedding and spare clothing they owned. The children would sleep all crowded into one bed, and yet even so, they could not keep warm. The outside ones would be shivering and sobbing, crawling over the others and trying to get down into the center and causing a fight. This old house, with the leaky weatherboards, was a very different thing from their cabins at home, with great thick walls plastered inside and outside with mud. And the cold which came upon them was a living thing, a demon presence in the room. They would waken in the midnight hours, when everything was black. Perhaps they would hear it yelling outside, or perhaps there would be death-like stillness. And that would be worse yet. They could feel the cold as it crept in through the cracks, reaching out for them with its icy, death-dealing fingers, and they would crouch and cower and try to hide from it, all in vain. It would come, and it would come. A grisly thing, a specter born in the black caverns of terror, a power primeval, cosmic, shadowing the tortures of the lost souls flung out to chaos and destruction. It was cruel, iron hard, and hour after hour they would cringe in its grasp, alone. There would be no one to hear them if they cried out. There would be no help, no mercy, and so on until morning, when they would go out to another day of toil, a little weaker, a little nearer to the time when it would be their turn to be shaken from the tree. Chapter 8. Yet even by this deadly winter the germ of hope was not to be kept from sprouting in their hearts. It was just at this time that the great adventure befell Maria. The victim was Tamosius Kuzleka, who played the violin. Everybody laughed at them, for Tamosius was petite and frail, and Maria could have picked him up and carried him off under one arm. But perhaps that was why she fascinated him. The sheer volume of Maria's energy was overwhelming. That first night at the wedding, Tamosius had hardly taken his eyes off her. And later on, when he came to find that she had really the heart of a baby, her voice and her violence ceased to terrify him, and he got the habit of coming to pay her visits on Sunday afternoons. There was no place to entertain company except in the kitchen, in the midst of the family, and Tamosius would sit there with his hat between his knees, never saying more than half a dozen words at a time, and turning red in the face before he managed to say those. Until finally, Jorgis would clap him upon the back in his hearty way, crying, "Come now, brother, give us a tune." And then Timoshus's face would light up, and he would get out his fiddle, tuck it under his chin, and play. And forthwith the soul of him would flame up and become eloquent. It was almost an impropriety, for all the while his gaze would be fixed upon Maria's face, until she would begin to turn red and lower her eyes. There was no resisting the music of Timoshus, however. Even the children would sit awed and wondering, and the tears would run down Teta Elzbieta's cheeks. A wonderful privilege it was to be thus admitted into the soul of a man of genius, to be allowed to share the ecstasies and the agonies of his inmost life. Then there were other benefits accruing to Maria from this friendship, benefits of a most substantial nature. People paid Timoshus big money to come and make music on state occasions, and also they would invite him to parties and festivals, knowing well that he was too good-natured to come without his fiddle, and that having brought it, he could be made to play while others danced. Once he made bold to ask Maria to accompany him to such a party, and Maria accepted, to his great delight. After which he never went anywhere without her, while if the celebration were given by friends of his, he would invite the rest of the family also. In any case, Maria would bring back a huge pocketful of cakes and sandwiches for the children, and stories of all the good things she herself had managed to consume. She was compelled at these parties to spend most of her time at the refreshment table, for she could not dance with anybody except other women and very old men. Timoshus was of an excitable temperament, and afflicted with a frantic jealousy, and any unmarried man who ventured to put his arm about the ample waist of Maria would be certain to throw the orchestra out of tune. It was a great help to a person who had to toil all the week to be able to look forward to some such relaxation as this on Saturday nights. The family were too poor and too hard-worked to make many acquaintances. In Packingtown, as a rule, people know only their near neighbors and shopmates, and so the place is like a myriad of little country villages. But now there was a member of the family who was permitted to travel and widen her horizon. And so each week there would be new personalities to talk about, how so-and-so is dressed, and where she worked, and what she got, and whom she was in love with, and how this man had jilted his girl, and how she had quarreled with the other girl, and what had passed between them, and how another man beat his wife and spent all her earnings upon drink and pawned her very clothes. Some people have scorned this talk as gossip, but then one has to talk about what one knows. It was one Saturday night, as they were coming home from a wedding, that Timoshus found courage and set down his violin case in the street and spoke his heart. And then Maria clasped him in her arms. She told them all about it the next day and fairly cried with happiness, for she said that Timoshus was a lovely man. After that, he no longer made love to her with his fiddle, but they would sit for hours in the kitchen, blissfully happy in each other's arms. It was the tacit convention of the family to know nothing of what was going on in that corner. They were planning to be married in the spring and have the garret of the house fixed up and live there. Timoshus made good wages, and little by little the family were paying back their debt to Maria, so she ought soon to have enough to start life upon. Only with her preposterous soft-heartedness, she would insist upon spending a good part of her money every week for things which she saw they needed. Maria was really the capitalist of the party, for she had become an expert can painter by this time. She was getting 14 cents for every 110 cans, and she could paint more than 2 cans every minute. Maria felt, so to speak, that she had her hand on the throttle, and the neighborhood was vocal with her rejoicings. Yet her friends would shake their heads and tell her to go slow. One could not count upon such good fortune forever. There were accidents that always happened. But Maria was not to be prevailed upon, and went on planning and dreaming of all the treasures she was going to have for her home. And so, when the crash did come, her grief was painful to see. For her canning factory shut down. Maria would about as soon have expected to see the sun shut down. The huge establishment had been to her a thing akin to the planets and the seasons. But now it was shut. And they had not given her any explanation. They had not even given her a day's warning. They had simply posted a notice one Saturday that all hands would be paid off that afternoon and would not resume work for at least a month. And that was all there was to it. Her job was gone. It was the holiday rush that was over, the girl said in answer to Maria's inquiries. After that, there was always a slack. Sometimes the factory would start up on half-time after a while, but there was no telling. It had been known to stay closed until way into the summer. The prospects were bad at present, for truckmen who worked in the storerooms said that these were piled up to the ceilings so that the firm could not have found room for another week's output of cans. And they had turned off 3/4 of these men, which was a still worse sign, since it meant that there were no orders to be filled. It was all a swindle, can painting, said the girls. You were crazy with delight because you were making $12 or $14 a week and saving half of it. But you had to spend it all keeping alive while you were out, and so your pay was really only half what you thought. Maria came home, and because she was a person who could not rest without danger of explosion, they first had a great house cleaning, and then she set out to search Packingtown for a job to fill up the gap. As nearly all the canning establishments were shut down and all the girls hunting work, it will be readily understood that Maria did not find any. Then she took to trying the stores and saloons, and when this failed, she even traveled over into the far distant regions near the lakefront, where lived the rich people in great palaces, and begged there for some sort of work that could be done by a person who did not know English. The men upon the killing beds felt also the effects of the slump which had turned Maria out, but they felt it in a different way, in a way which made Jurgis understand at last all their bitterness. The big packers did not turn their hands off and close down, like the canning factories, but they began to run for shorter and shorter hours. They had always required the men to be on the killing beds and ready for work at 7 o'clock, although there was almost never any work to be done till the buyers out in the yards had gotten to work and some cattle had come over the chutes. That would often be 10 or 11 o'clock, which was bad enough in all conscience. But now, in the slack season, they would perhaps not have a thing for their men to do till late in the afternoon, and so they would have to loaf around in a place where the thermometer might be 20 degrees below zero. At first, one would see them running about or skylarking with each other, trying to keep warm, but before the day was over, they would become quite chilled through and exhausted, and when the cattle finally came, so near frozen that to move was an agony, and then suddenly the place would spring into activity, and the merciless speeding up would begin. There were weeks at a time when Jurgis went home after such a day as this with not more than 2 hours' work to his credit, which meant about 35 cents. There were many days when the total was less than half an hour, and others when there was none at all. The general average was 6 hours a day, which meant for Jurgis about $6 a week. And this 6 hours of work would be done after standing on the killing bed till 1 o'clock, or perhaps even 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Like as not, there would come a rush of cattle at the very end of the day, which the men would have to dispose of before they went home, often working by electric light till 9 or 10, or even 12 or 1 o'clock, and without a single instant for a bite of supper. The men were at the mercy of the cattle. Perhaps the buyers would be holding off for better prices. If they could scare the shippers into thinking that they meant to buy nothing that day, they could get their own terms. For some reason, the cost of fodder for cattle in the yards was much above the market price, and you were not allowed to bring your own fodder. Then, too, a number of cars were apt to arrive late in the day, now that the roads were blocked with snow, and the packers would buy their cattle that night to get them cheaper, and then would come into play their ironclad rule that all cattle must be killed the same day they were bought. There was no use kicking about this. There had been one delegation after another to see the packers about it, only to be told that it was the rule, and that there was not the slightest chance of it ever being altered. And so on Christmas Eve, Jurgis worked till nearly 1 o'clock in the morning, and on Christmas Day, he was on the killing bed at 7 o'clock. All this was bad, and yet it was not the worst. For after all the hard work a man did, he was paid for only part of it. Jurgis had once been among those who scoffed at the idea of these huge concerns cheating, and so now he could appreciate the bitter irony of the fact that it was precisely their size which enabled them to do it with impunity. One of the rules on the killing beds was that a man who was 1 minute late was docked an hour, and this was economical, for he was made to work the balance of the hour, he was not allowed to stand round and wait. And on the other hand, if he came ahead of time, he got no pay for that, though often the bosses would start up the gang 10 or 15 minutes before the whistle. And this same custom they carried over to the end of the day. They did not pay for any fraction of an hour, for broken time. A man might work full 50 minutes, but if there was no work to fill out the hour, there was no pay for him. Thus the end of every day was a sort of lottery, a struggle, all but breaking into open war between the bosses and the men, the former trying to rush a job through and the latter trying to stretch it out. Jorgis blamed the bosses for this, though the truth to be told, it was not always their fault, for the packers kept them frightened for their lives. And when one was in danger of falling behind the standard, what was easier than to catch up by making the gang work a while for the church? This was a savage witticism the men had, which Jorgis had to have explained to him. Old Man Jones was great on missions and such things, and so whenever they were doing some particularly disreputable job, the men would wink at each other and say, "Now we're working for the church." One of the consequences of all these things was that Jorgis was no longer perplexed when he heard men talk of fighting for their rights. He felt like fighting now himself. And when the Irish delegate of the Butcher Helpers Union came to him a second time, he received him in a far different spirit. A wonderful idea it now seemed to Jorgis, this of the men, that by combining they might be able to make a stand and conquer the packers. Jorgis wondered who had first thought of it, and when he was told that it was a common thing for men to do in America, he got the first inkling of a meaning in the phrase, a free country. The delegate explained to him how it depended upon their being able to get every man to join and stand by the organization, and so Jorgis signified that he was willing to do his share. Before another month was by, all the working members of his family had union cards, and wore their union buttons conspicuously and with pride. For fully a week they were quite blissfully happy, thinking that belonging to a union meant an end of all their troubles. But only 10 days after she had joined, Maria's canning factory closed down, and that blow quite staggered them. They could not understand why the union had not prevented it. And the very first time she attended a meeting, Maria got up and made a speech about it. It was a business meeting, and was transacted in English, but that made no difference to Maria. She said what was in her, and all the pounding of the chairman's gavel and all the uproar and confusion in the room could not prevail. Quite apart from her own troubles, she was boiling over with a general sense of the injustice of it, and she told what she thought of the packers, and what she thought of a world where such things were allowed to happen. And then, while the echoes of the hall rang with the shock of her terrible voice, she sat down again and fanned herself, and the meeting gathered itself together and proceeded to discuss the election of a recording secretary. Jorgis, too, had an adventure the first time he attended a union meeting, but it was not of his own seeking. Jorgis had gone with the desire to get into an inconspicuous corner and see what was done. But this attitude of silent and open-eyed attention had marked him out for a victim. Tommy Finnegan was a little Irishman with big, staring eyes and a wild aspect, a hoister by trade, and badly cracked. Somewhere back in the far distant past, Tommy Finnegan had had a strange experience, and the burden of it rested upon him. All the balance of his life he had done nothing but try to make it understood. When he talked, he caught his victim by the buttonhole, and his face kept coming closer and closer, which was trying because his teeth were so bad. Jorgis did not mind that, only he was frightened. The method of operation of the higher intelligences was Tommy Finnegan's theme, and he desired to find out if Jorgis had ever considered that representation of things in their present similarity might be altogether unintelligible upon a more elevated plane. There were assuredly wonderful mysteries about the developing of these things. And then, becoming confidential, Mr. Finnegan proceeded to tell of some discoveries of his own. "If you ever had anything to do with spirits," said he, and looked inquiringly at Jorgis, who kept shaking his head. "Never mind, never mind," continued the other. "But their influences may be operating upon you. It's sure as I'm telling you. It's them that has the reference to the immediate surroundings that has the most of the power. It was vouchsafed to me in my youthful days to be acquainted with spirits." And so Tommy Finnegan went on, expounding a system of philosophy, while the perspiration came out of Jorgis's forehead, so great was his agitation and embarrassment. In the end, one of the men, seeing his plight, came over and rescued him. but it was some time before he was able to find anyone to explain things to him. And meanwhile, his fear lest the strange little Irishman should get him cornered again was enough to keep him dodging about the room the whole evening. He never missed a meeting, however. He had picked up a few words of English by this time, and friends would help him to understand. They were often very turbulent meetings, with half a dozen men declaiming at once, in as many dialects of English. But the speakers were all desperately in earnest, and Jurgis was in earnest too, for he understood that a fight was on, and that it was his fight. Since the time of his disillusionment, Jurgis had sworn to trust no man, except in his own family. But here he discovered that he had brothers in affliction and allies. Their one chance for life was in union, and so the struggle became a crusade. Jurgis had always been a member of the church, because it was the right thing to be. But the church had never touched him. He left all that for the women. Here, however, was a new religion, one that did touch him, that took hold of every fiber of him. And with all the zeal and fury of a convert, he went out as a missionary. There were many non-union men among the Lithuanians, and with these he would labor and wrestle in prayer, trying to show them the right. Sometimes they would be obstinate and refuse to see it, and Jurgis, alas, was not always patient. He forgot how he himself had been blind a short time ago, after the fashion of all crusaders since the original ones, who set out to spread the gospel of brotherhood by force of arms. Chapter 9. One of the first consequences of the discovery of the Union was that Jurgis became desirous of learning English. He wanted to know what was going on at the meetings, and to be able to take part in them, and so he began to look about him and to try to pick up words. The children who were at school and learning fast would teach him a few, and a friend loaned him a little book that had some in it, and Ona would read them to him. Then Jurgis became sorry that he could not read himself, and later on in the winter, when someone told him that there was a night school that was free, he went and enrolled. After that, every evening that he got home from the yards in time, he would go to the school. He would go even if he were in time for only half an hour. They were teaching him both to read and speak English, and they would have taught him other things, if only he had a little time. Also, the Union made another great difference with him. It made him begin to pay attention to the country. It was the beginning of democracy with him. It was a little state, the Union, a miniature republic. Its affairs were every man's affairs, and every man had a real say about them. In other words, in the Union, Jurgis learned to talk politics. In the place where he had come from, there had not been any politics. In Russia, one thought of the government as an affliction, like the lightning and the hail. "Duck, little brother, duck," the wise old peasants would whisper. "Everything passes away." And when Jurgis had first come to America, he had supposed that it was the same. He had heard people say that it was a free country, but what did that mean? He found that here, precisely as in Russia, there were rich men who owned everything. And if one could not find any work, was not the hunger he began to feel the same sort of hunger? When Jurgis had been working about 3 weeks at Brown's, there had come to him one noontime a man who was employed as a night watchman, and who asked him if he would not like to take out naturalization papers and become a citizen. Jurgis did not know what that meant, but the man explained the advantages. In the first place, it would not cost him anything, and it would get him half a day off, with his pay just the same. And then, when election time came, he would be able to vote. And there was something in that. Jurgis was naturally glad to accept, and so the night watchman said a few words to the boss, and he was excused for the rest of the day. When later on he wanted a holiday to get married, he could not get it. And as for a holiday with pay just the same, what power had wrought that miracle, heaven only knew. However, he went with the man, who picked up several other newly landed immigrants, Poles, Lithuanians, and Slovaks, and took them all outside, where stood a great 4-horse tally-ho coach, with 15 or 20 men already in it. It was a fine chance to see the sights of the city, and the party had a merry time, with plenty of beer handed up from inside. So they drove downtown and stopped before an imposing granite building, in which they interviewed an official, who had the papers all ready, with only the names to be filled in. So each man in turn took an oath of which he did not understand a word, and then was presented with a handsome, ornamented document with a big red seal and the shield of the United States upon it. and was told that he had become a citizen of the Republic and the equal of the president himself. A month or two later, Jurgis had another interview with the same man, who told him where to go to register. And then finally, when election day came, the packing houses posted a notice that men who desired to vote might remain away until 9 that morning, and the same night watchman took Jurgis and the rest of his flock into the back room of a saloon and showed each of them where and how to mark a ballot, and then gave each $2, and took them to the polling place, where there was a policeman on duty especially to see that they got through all right. Jurgis felt quite proud of this good luck, till he got home and met Jonas, who had taken the leader aside and whispered to him, offering to vote 3 times for $4, which offer had been accepted. And now, in the Union, Jurgis met men who explained all this mystery to him, and he learned that America differed from Russia and that its government existed under the form of a democracy. The officials who ruled it, and got all the graft, had to be elected first. And so there were two rival sets of grafters, known as political parties, and the one got the office which bought the most votes. Now and then the election was very close, and that was the time the poor man came in. In the stockyards, this was only in national and state elections, for in local elections the Democratic Party always carried everything. The ruler of the district was therefore the Democratic boss, a little Irishman named Mike Scully. Scully held an important party office in the state, and bossed even the mayor of the city, it was said. It was his boast that he carried the stockyards in his pocket. He was an enormously rich man. He had a hand in all the big graft in the neighborhood. It was Scully, for instance, who owned that dump which Jurgis and Ona had seen the first day of their arrival. Not only did he own the dump, but he owned the brick factory as well. And first he took out the clay and made it into bricks, and then he had the city bring garbage to fill up the hole, so that he could build houses to sell to the people. Then, too, he sold the bricks to the city at his own price, and the city came and got them in its own wagons. And also he owned the other hole nearby, where the stagnant water was, and it was he who cut the ice and sold it. And what was more, if the men told the truth, he had not had to pay any taxes for the water, and he had built the ice house out of city lumber, and had not had to pay anything for that. The newspapers had got hold of that story, and there had been a scandal, but Scully had hired somebody to confess and take all the blame, and then skip the country. It was said, too, that he had built his brick kiln in the same way, and that the workmen were on the city payroll while they did it. However, one had to press closely to get these things out of the men, for it was not their business, and Mike Scully was a good man to stand in with. A note signed by him was equal to a job any time at the packing house, and also he employed a good many men himself, and worked them only 8 hours a day, and paid them the highest wages. This gave him many friends, all of whom he had gotten together into the War Whoop League, whose clubhouse you might see just outside of the yards. It was the biggest clubhouse and the biggest club in all Chicago, and they had prize fights every now and then, and cockfights, and even dogfights. The policemen in the district all belonged to the league, and instead of suppressing the fights, they sold tickets for them. The man that had taken Jurgis to be naturalized was one of these Indians, as they were called, and on election day there would be hundreds of them out, and all with big wads of money in their pockets and free drinks at every saloon in the district. That was another thing, the men said. All the saloon keepers had to be Indians, and to put up on demand, otherwise they could not do business on Sundays, nor have any gambling at all. In the same way, Scully had all the jobs in the fire department at his disposal, and all the rest of the city graft in the stockyards district. He was building a block of flats somewhere up on Ashland Avenue, and the man who was overseeing it for him was drawing pay as a city inspector of sewers. The city inspector of water pipes had been dead and buried for over a year, but somebody was still drawing his pay. The city inspector of sidewalks was a barkeeper at the War Whoop Cafe, and maybe he could make it uncomfortable for any tradesman who did not stand in with Scully. Even the packers were in awe of him, so the men said. It gave them pleasure to believe this, for Scully stood as the people's man and boasted of it boldly when election day came. The packers had wanted a bridge at Ashland Avenue, but they had not been able to get it till they had seen Scully. And it was the same with Bubbly Creek, which the city had threatened to make the Packers cover over till Scully had come to their aid. Bubbly Creek is an arm of the Chicago River and forms the southern boundary of the yards. All the drainage of the square mile of packing houses empties into it, so that it is really a great open sewer, 100 or 2 feet wide. One long arm of it is blind, and the filth stays there forever and a day. The grease and chemicals that are poured into it undergo all sorts of strange transformations, which are the cause of its name. It is constantly in motion, as if huge fish were feeding in it, or great leviathans disporting themselves in its depths. Bubbles of carbonic acid gas will rise to the surface and burst, and make rings 2 or 3 feet wide. Here and there, the grease and filth have caked solid, and the creek looks like a bed of lava. Chickens walk about on it, feeding, and many times an unwary stranger has started to stroll across and vanished temporarily. The Packers used to leave the creek that way, till every now and then the surface would catch on fire and burn furiously, and the fire department would have to come and put it out. Once, however, an ingenious stranger came out and started to gather this filth and scows to make lard out of it. And then the Packers took the cue and got out an injunction to stop him, and afterwards gathered it themselves. The banks of Bubbly Creek are plastered thick with hairs, and this also the Packers gather and clean. And there were things even stranger than this, according to the gossip of the men. The Packers had secret mains through which they stole billions of gallons of the city's water. The newspapers had been full of this scandal. Once there had even been an investigation and an actual uncovering of the pipes, but nobody had been punished, and the thing went right on. And then there was the condemned meat industry with its endless horrors. The people of Chicago saw the government inspectors in Packingtown, and they all took that to mean that they were protected from diseased meat. They did not understand that these 163 inspectors had been appointed at the request of the Packers, and that they were paid by the United States government to certify that all the diseased meat was kept in the state. They had no authority beyond that. For the inspection of meat to be sold in the city and state, the whole force in Packingtown consisted of 3 henchmen of the local political machine. And shortly afterward, one of these, a physician, made the discovery that the carcasses of steers which had been condemned as tubercular by the government inspectors, and which therefore contained ptomaines, which are deadly poisons, were left upon an open platform and carted away to be sold in the city. And so he insisted that these carcasses be treated with an injection of kerosene, and was ordered to resign the same week. So indignant were the Packers that they went farther, and compelled the mayor to abolish the whole Bureau of Inspection. So that since then, there has not been even a pretense of any interference with the graft. There was said to be $2,000 a week hush money from the tubercular steers alone, and as much again from the hogs which had died of cholera on the trains, and which you might see any day being loaded into boxcars and hauled away to a place called Globe in Indiana, where they made a fancy grade of lard. Footnote: Rules and Regulations for the Inspection of Livestock and Their Products. United States Department of Agriculture, Bureau of Animal Industries, Order Number 125. Section 1. Proprietors of slaughterhouses, canning, salting, packing, or rendering establishments engaged in the slaughtering of cattle, sheep, or swine, or the packing of any of their products, the carcasses or products of which are to become subjects of interstate or foreign commerce, shall make application to the Secretary of Agriculture for inspection of said animals and their products. Section 15. Such rejected or condemned animals shall at once be removed by the owners from the pens containing animals which have been inspected and found to be free from disease and fit for human food, and shall be disposed of in accordance with the laws, ordinances, and regulations of the state and municipality in which said rejected or condemned animals are located. Section 25. A microscopic examination for trichinae shall be made of all swine products exported to countries requiring such examination, No microscopic examination will be made of hogs slaughtered for interstate trade, but this examination shall be confined to those intended for the export trade. Jurgis heard of these things little by little in the gossip of those who were obliged to perpetuate them. It seemed as if every time you met a person from a new department, you heard of new swindles and new crimes. There was, for instance, a Lithuanian who was a cattle butcher for the plant where Maria had worked, which killed meat for canning only. And to hear this man describe the animals which came to his place would have been worthwhile for a Dante or a Zola. It seemed that they must have agencies all over the country to hunt out old and crippled and diseased cattle to be canned. There were cattle which had been fed on whiskey malt, the refuse of the breweries, and had become what men called steerly, which means covered with boils. It was a nasty job killing these, for when you plunged your knife into them, they would burst and splash foul-smelling stuff into your face. And when a man's sleeves were smeared with blood and his hands steeped in it, how was he ever to wipe his face or to clear his eyes so that he could see? It was stuff such as this that made the embalmed beef that had killed several times as many United States soldiers as all the bullets of the Spaniards. Only the army beef, besides, was not fresh canned. It was old stuff that had been lying for years in the cellars. Then one Sunday evening, Jurgis sat puffing his pipe by the kitchen stove and talking with an old fellow whom Jonas had introduced and who worked in the canning rooms at Durham's. And so Jurgis learned a few things about the great and only Durham canned goods, which had become a national institution. They were regular alchemists at Durham's. They advertised a mushroom ketchup, and the men who made it did not know what a mushroom looked like. They advertised potted chicken, and it was like the boarding house soup of the comic papers, through which a chicken had walked with rubbers on. Perhaps they had a secret process for making chickens chemically. Who knows, said Jurgis's friends. The things that went into the mixture were tripe, and the fat of pork, and beef suet, and hearts of beef, and finally, the waste ends of veal, when they had any. They put these up in several grades and sold them at several prices, but the contents of the cans all came out of the same hopper. And then there was potted game, and potted grouse, potted ham, and deviled ham. Deviled, as the men called it. Deviled ham was made out of the waste ends of smoked beef that were too small to be sliced by the machines, and also tripe, dyed with chemicals so that it would not show white, and trimmings of hams and corned beef and potatoes, skins and all. And finally, the hard, cartilaginous gullets of beef after the tongues have been cut out. All this ingenious mixture was ground up and flavored with spices to make it taste like something. Anybody who could invent a new imitation had been sure of a fortune from old Durham, said Jurgis's informant. But it was hard to think of anything new in a place where so many sharp wits had been at work for so long, where men welcomed tuberculosis in the cattle they were feeding because it made them fatten more quickly, and where they bought up all the old rancid butter left over in the grocery stores of a continent and oxidized it by a forced air process to take away the odor, rechurned it with skim milk, and sold it in bricks in the cities. Up to a year or two ago, it had been the custom to kill horses in the yards, ostensibly for fertilizer, but after long agitation, the newspapers had been able to make the public realize that the horses were being canned. Now it was against the law to kill horses in Packingtown, and the law was really complied with, for the present at any rate. Any day, however, one might see sharp-horned and shaggy-haired creatures running with the sheep. And yet, what a job you would have to get the public to believe that a good part of what it buys for lamb and mutton is really goat's flesh. There was another interesting set of statistics that a person might have gathered in Packingtown. Those of the various afflictions of the workers. When Jurgis had first inspected the packing plants with Shedvilas, he had marveled while he listened to the tale of all things that were made out of the carcasses of animals, and of all the lesser industries that were maintained there. Now he found that each one of these lesser industries was a separate little inferno, in its way as horrible as the killing beds, the source and fountain of them all. The workers in each of them had their own peculiar diseases, and the wandering visitor might be skeptical about all the swindles, but he could not be skeptical about these, for the worker bore the evidence of them about on his own person. Generally, he had only to hold out his hand. There were the men in the pickle rooms, for instance, where old Antanas had gotten his death. Scarce a one of these that had not some spot of horror on his person. Let a man so much as scrape his finger pushing a